Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilcrease Museum is currently hosting a retrospective exhibit of Western American painter Edgar Payne, which attempts to offer new insights to this painter of beautiful landscapes. Payne is known to different people for different things. For Californians, Payne is known as a painter of powerful views of the California coastline or the Sierra Nevada mountains. In our part of the country, Payne is best known for his iconic views of the American Southwest and of the Navajo herdsmen in Canyon de Chaillé in northeastern Arizona. For still others, Payne is best known for his European work in the Alps or the harbors of Brittany. Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey, brings these components together into one show and shows that Payne, while essentially a fairly conservative early 20th century realist painter, was always searching for new ways and techniques to express nature and the wondrous landscape. My guest today is Scott Shields, the Associate Director and Chief Curator of the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, California, one of the organizers of the show. The exhibit showed there, as well as the Pasadena Art Museum, and Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey, will be on display through March 24th here at Gilcrease Museum. Scott Shields joins me today to talk about the artwork of Edgar Payne. Scott Shields, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This exhibit at Gilcrease, Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey. I knew Edgar Payne for his Canyon de Chaillé paintings, which were sort of very iconic of the American West, but this was a very interesting exhibit which sort of shared what an incredible painterly painter Edgar Payne is. Was that the design of the exhibit?
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised. I was surprised the other way. I knew his paintings mostly as Sierra scenes with lakes. And for me, the surprise was in the European boat pictures and also in the southwestern Canyon de Chaillé paintings. So I'd seen some, but not nearly as many as by the time the exhibition got up and on the wall.
Now, Edgar Payne is probably known to most aficionados of Western American art or California art for that California Impressionism. He's really not a major name. Do you think this exhibit sort of gives new cachet to his artwork? Because he didn't move a whole lot stylistically throughout his painting career, but it seemed like he was always searching for new views to popularize, if you will.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that was kind of wonderful as a curator to work on this show is that his trajectory was really clear, and he had great segues from one subject to the next. So it kind of began with the California fields and rolling hills, and then it moved to the Laguna coasts, and then it went to the Sierra, and then he went to Europe, and then ended up in the Southwest. And it's almost decade by decade you can trace where he was going, and he really was always trying to stay ahead of, you know, the next thing, and how does he keep his art relevant? His style did change, but it's, you know, you kind of have to have looked at a lot of Payne to really see how it's changed.
His brushwork changes a little bit. He almost, at one point, he sort of, I always associated the style with Birger Sanson. It's almost like a daubed method, somewhat pointillistic, but not really pointillistic. And then he sort of abandons that in some of the later paintings.
He did, and he became really the most advanced in that way when he was in Europe, and he was looking at the pointillists and the post-impressionists, and I think he was really saying, do I need to sort of take this route to keep on top of things? And he then sort of pulls back from that. So when he's in Europe, some of those paintings are really quite modern in the application of the paint, but when he gets later, he figures out how to use that to its best advantage. Like in the Brittany boat paintings, his brushwork becomes almost kaleidoscopic, which works well with the color of the boats, with the reflections on the water. And then later, when he's in the Southwest, it becomes more about atmosphere and changing weather and things like that. And his brushwork becomes, I guess, smoother. Maybe that's not the right word, but it's less mosaic-like.
I think that's a good, because he's painting, of course, as many painters in the desert Southwest, he's painting the light as much as anything, and the light and the rocks.
Yes, absolutely. But if you look at the difference between his 1916 early Canyon de Chaillé works when he first went there versus the works he did in the 1930s when the vast majority of them were painted, those two early ones are much blockier, heavier, and there's a different feeling about them. Later, he's more interested in things that move, like clouds and wind and rain and things like that, versus the first ones, which are so much about the stone and the permanency of those stones.
Now Edgar Payne was self-taught. He grew up, he was born just about 150 miles from here, near Cassville, Missouri, at a little town called Washburn. Grew up in Prairie Grove, Arkansas, and then left home, I guess ran away, because his father wanted him to be a carpenter, right?
Yeah, well, his father, I don't think, was an easy man, and Edgar wanted to paint, and so he did run away twice. Both times was retrieved. But he really was almost entirely self-taught. He studied for 2 weeks at the Art Institute of Chicago, which is not even enough to get your feet wet, and decided, he said, nature is the best teacher for me, and he just didn't like the classroom experience, and, you know, his education was not that long, and so I think that it just was not, he was not accustomed to it and didn't like it and wasn't going to do it.
And so he was self-taught, and a lot of it was plein air painting, correct?
Yes, and it was both in Chicago, where he ended up working for many, many years, and then California. So he makes his first trip to California in 1909, and then he goes back and forth until about 1925, when he finally leaves Chicago permanently. And so he's coming out to California to sketch and to get ideas, and then he goes back to Chicago and exhibits the paintings there for the most part. And it was in California that he met his wife, Elsie Palmer, who was also an artist. And she didn't think much of his paintings at all. In fact, she says, "I find his colors dull." And a friend of Payne says, "Don't worry, he's been in Chicago too long, but once he's in California for a while, he'll get it." And it didn't take him long to get it. And he started to use much brighter colors, much more impressionist stroke.
One of the things that's interesting about this exhibit is you see what a creatively artistic person he was in a whole range of fields. We mentioned his father was a carpenter. He obviously learned carpentry skills, because there are examples of his woodwork, a sculpture. He actually built a scale model of a Brittany fishing boat. I assume this was so when he went back to his studio, he'd sort of have this model of exactly what a Brittany fishing boat would look like. He designed some furniture pieces. He was also an accomplished photographer.
Yeah, he was pretty good at whatever he put his hand to. And the furniture was really interesting to me, because for a long time we were trying to figure out, how did he learn how to do this? And then just at the sort of last minute before all the publication went to press, we found a census from 1900, and it said, John Payne, carpenter, Edgar Payne, carpenter's apprentice. And that was the moment. It's like, oh, he learned it from his father. And we didn't really understand that his father was a carpenter, and that's where that comes from. So he did these beautiful pieces of carved, for lack of a better term, arts and crafts furniture. The boat that he made, and he made others other than that one, I think was both for his own edification, but also he used that in his paintings. If there's one painting in the show that looks exactly like the boat model, and I think especially on his second trip to Europe in 1928, he was only there for 3 months. So he took as many photos as he could, did as many drawings as he could, and then he did most of the paintings back in the United States. And that boat model, you know, he could use it for perspective, he could see how it would interact with other boats, and I think that it really became kind of a compositional device that he used. So it was important for more than just, you know, something, some hobby to do on this spare time.
And there's a sculpture of this crazy birdhouse. It looks like something from a 70 or 80s kids show. It is a very long, it's a long, tall vertical piece of just these sort of scatter shack sort of high roof buildings, one on top of each other for, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet high, something like that.
It's pretty large, and it's really, you know, we call it the birdhouse, but it's really not even a birdhouse. We're not sure why he made that. It has some relationship to some of his European paintings, because it has turrets, and it's much like some of those paintings he did of French castles in the countryside. But other than that, I think he just did that one just mostly for fun. And what his purpose was, nobody's really quite sure.
Well, it's a beautiful piece, nonetheless.
Yeah.
My guest today is Scott Shields, the Associate Director and Chief Curator of the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, and one of the organizers for the traveling exhibit Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey, which is on display through March 24th at Gilcrease Museum. Actually, the first stop was at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, if we can talk a little bit, some of the first exhibits we see in the Tulsa show are those beautiful, beautiful Sierra paintings. and rugged slopes in Tamarack, pictures of Lake Louise, the hills of Altadena, out just in Southern California, some of the hill country views. But he was very fond of going up high in the Sierras to that place right below, or maybe right next to top of a peak, where inevitably there would be a little alpine lake that basically captures the snowmelt from the actual peak. And he loved that view, didn't he?
He really did. And that's really what made his reputation early on. And he became quite famous for those. And he wanted to exploit an area that people hadn't been able to. And when the show is at the Crocker, we have a very big room, and we borrowed a car for the exhibition, a Model T like he used, because he was one of the first artists that was able to exploit the automobile. And he would drive as far as he possibly could, and then he would connect with these, they would have places where you could rent pack teams, and he would go up with mules and go as far as he possibly could, and then he would do small oil sketches and drawings out, and then come back to his studio and turn them into big paintings. We looked a lot at the views he was looking at, and sometimes they're exactly what you're seeing there, and sometimes he would move things. So if there wasn't a lake in the right place, he might take one from 4 or 5 miles away and push it into the view. Same thing with mountain peaks. He would sometimes move those around for the best composition. But he really was trying to exploit this untouched wilderness. And whereas in the Southwestern paintings later, you get a lot of figures that sort of give a sense of scale to the landscape. There are not that many paintings from the Sierra scenes that have figures in them. It's much more pristine. Occasionally you get a view of a hiker or a packer, and he would enlist students with the idea that, oh, well, why don't you go with me and you can learn? But he would actually put them to work, and they'd have to haul all the gear and do the heavy lifting and cooking. I'm sure they gained a little bit of insight, but he was not a stupid man. He was always figuring out ways to make things work.
Was he involved in the politics of the Sierra at the time? Because if I remember right, the 19-teens, this was the time when it was, you know, starting the Sierra Club, and this was sort of a big push to save the Sierra Nevada in its sort of natural state as opposed to exploiting that mountain range. Was he a part of the politics of that scene? Because that was a pretty big political thing going on in the 19-teens.
I think he sympathized with that scene. He wasn't really involved because most of the politics at that moment were going on farther north, and he was really one of the first to really exploit what was the Southern California landscape. So prior to Payne, a lot of artists were doing Yosemite, they were doing Mount Shasta, they were doing scenes of Mount Tamalpais in the Bay Area, but those mountains in Southern California are hard to get to today, and they were extraordinarily hard to get to then. But he sympathized with Muir's ideas and this idea of preservation, and he said, the problem with Europe is that the hotels follow you everywhere. You can't get a pure landscape, and if you look at his European scenes of the Alps, there's almost always a village in them somewhere or buildings in them, which was quite different than in the southern part of California.
Of course, he's also painting Southern California hill country views, hills of Altadena I mentioned earlier. And it's interesting because probably those are filled with houses today, but the landscapes he's painting are still pristine at this point in the early 19-teens.
Yeah, they were. And there was a lot of concern among artists and others that the landscape was so rapidly being developed there that the population was just doubling and doubling and doubling. And so I think they thought of themselves as recording something that was going to be lost. And it turned out they were right. So a lot of the scenes he painted, you couldn't possibly, you know. The Sierra ones still pretty much as they were, but the ones that are more inland and in the valley is just completely different.
It's interesting. At about the late 19-teens, you can start seeing him exploring techniques. And as I mentioned earlier, that sort of mosaic technique that Birger Sanson and others were messing with, you can see that. And there's a couple of interesting pieces. There's one called Eucalyptus Landscape and a couple others from about the same time period where it's sort of like ranch land, it looks like. And he's actively really painting the sky almost down to the ground in this almost like a cloud sort of. It was the most unusual paintings I think I saw on the show because he was so active in painting the negative space.
Yeah, and that's something that he tackled off and on over the course of his career. The Sierra paintings are mostly about the sort of iconic mountain forms, but those early ones, a lot of them are about the sky. And then later in the Southwest, sometimes you get great views of, really, the paintings become about clouds more than they are about the landscape itself.
There's one painting from the Southwest period which struck me because, when we think of the Southwest, we think of the light being beautiful at first light and at last light, and that overhead sun is just so powerful in the Southwest, it washes everything out. There's actually a painting where it looks like that was the view, and he was trying to capture that midday washing out of the light. It's a very long view of looking down into the canyon, and to me, that was an unusual, it was almost like it was an exercise, but except it was such a large-scale painting that it couldn't have been an exercise.
Yeah, I think you're talking about one called Blue Canyon, which it really is. The light is so bright that it sort of dissolves the landscape of this canyon, which is part of Canyon de Chelly. And I think that, that comes out of the Impressionists and people like Monet who are, dissolving haystacks and light and cathedral fronts and things like that. But he's sort of applying it to the Southwestern landscape. But he really pushes that one farther than most, in that you do start to lose the scene at hand. And what a hard thing to try to figure out how to paint.
Right, because you can still see what's there in the distance, but there's a haze that's there, and he paints the haze, which is pretty amazing, I think.
Yeah, not an easy thing to accomplish. And he was quite skilled at his craft, and it didn't take him that long. If you look at the very earliest pieces in the show, you do see a definite change from what he was starting out doing, and then it doesn't take very long. As his friend said, he'll get it. And it didn't take much time at all. A couple of years, so from 1911 to by 1915, he was kind of in his form.
Now, how in touch with the other painting community was Edgar Payne? Because the next section of the show deals with seascapes, and of course seascapes were a very popular 19th century American as well as European topic, and certainly when you think of like William Tross Richards or something like that, the seascapes and these sort of shoreline paintings, that was his forte. And Edgar Payne takes his own view of it, and they're beautiful breaker paintings, if you will, waves breaking on the shore, rocky shore. Was he much in touch with the rest of the painting community of that time?
I would say yes. Most artists certainly knew of what was going on in the world. I think that we always picture them being isolated before the era of television, but they looked at everything they could. They went to exhibitions, they looked at publications, and so they were tracking what was going on. And he was also in touch with the art community around Laguna, where those paintings were created. And anytime he would get involved in something, he would take a leadership role. So he had a very active leadership role in the formation of the Laguna Beach Art Association, which is today the museum. So he knew what was going on in the world. And beyond that, one of the things that really was interesting for me in those coastal paintings was the period in which they were done was right the period of World War I, and especially a painting called Restless Sea, for me became more than just a seascape. It became emblematic of what was going on at the world at the time, and he exhibited it right on the eve of America's entry into World War I. And so you look at the title, which is Restless Sea, and the sort of battle of the elements of the ocean and the rocky coast, and then you start to read things that he's writing. He's writing about how do we strive for peace. His brother was in the war, and he didn't come back, and they thought he was dead, and he ultimately did come back, but they didn't know that. His wife, Elsie, was in the Red Cross, so he's really thinking about not only his artistic colleagues, but the world at large, and I think that those battling ocean paintings sort of sum that up. And there are a lot of the other titles are kind of the same way. One of Monterey Cypress is called Sentinels of the Coast, for instance.
Right.
Could have called it Monterey Cypress. but it has a more battle-sounding sentinel.
There's two those breaker paintings that you mentioned, Restless Sea. The other one was The Eternal Surge, done about 3 years later. It's almost of the same exact scene, same sort of breaking of the waves. And yet they're very different light, different color palette that's used in it. It's I found The Eternal Surge, the way he used the light sudsy water, the way he painted it was the most unusual look to it. It looked absolutely realistic, but it was utterly different than I think I've seen in most paintings of that type.
And he was really, at that moment, experimenting with color. I was struck, one of the newspaper articles after the war had ended said that Payne has a new exhibition, and many of them are painted in joyful pastel tints. and I haven't seen too many joyful pastel tint Paynes, but and that critic actually suggested that he was happy about, you know, the end of the war and the change in perception of what was going on broadly. And so that probably tied into that a little bit, of those different colors that were coming out.
After the war, I think this was when he made his first trip to Europe, and in the show you'll see a number of views of the Matterhorn. And it's a very interesting because, you know, he's there in the 1920s, early 1920s. You're seeing things like Leger, and, you know, modernism is in full flower, and the art movements of Europe are changing seemingly every year, looking for the new next thing. And I was wondering how he reacted to that, or was he in touch with that, or was he just about going out into nature and painting landscapes?
I think both. First, his concern was, you know, always about nature and landscape, and that was what he did. But I think he grappled with it in the way that he handled the paint application. So some of the Great White Peak paintings, which is Mount Blanc, the Matterhorn, he's really approaching his application to paint. The brush strokes become sometimes 1 by 2 inches each, or maybe even bigger than that, and it's applied on there. And the form is so iconic, so he's sort of stepping back from the subject and saying, how can I make this painting, this surface, this sort of abstraction on that level? And he said later in his own book that he wrote, part of what makes a beautiful painting is a beautiful surface. And so he thought a lot about the way he applied paint, and that really comes forth in those European paintings.
You can see his impasto is growing thicker, and certainly in a lot of those Alps paintings, you're starting to see pointillistic effects. There's a couple of the Matterhorn paintings where there's a daubing of an unusual color into it. It's almost creating that mosaic idea. But these paintings are meant to be looked at from a great distance, I think, because you really see how it molds into a sort of a veil, if you will, over the scene in a certain way.
Yeah, because the first thing you see is the surface, not the depth of the scene at hand.
Yeah,
and that's a very modern idea. And then, you know, in that paint laying flat on the surface, and a lot of artists were thinking about that. That it's really not an illusionistic window into a three-dimensional world. It's paint on a flat surface, and so a lot of artists were playing with that idea. And Payne was fairly successful when he was in Europe. He exhibited his works at the Paris Salon. So you tend to think of, you know, the ones that stand out are the great modern masters, but a lot of artists weren't doing that. And so among those that weren't, he was certainly right in there. And the paintings that he exhibited first at the Salon, one was of a Sierra scene and one was of a European scene. And they were clearly meant as a pair. And he was comparing European scenery with California scenery. Interestingly, the French judges picked the European scene to give a prize to, and they didn't pick the California scene. And the prize winners got to hang in a better spot. And Payne said, no, these two go together. And so he managed to get both of those paintings shown in the prize-winning spot, even though only one of them won a prize.
Interesting. He sounds like he was an interesting sort. Pretty much you did it his way or not at all.
I think that's true. And one of my favorite stories about him was that on the day of his wedding, he said to his wife, his future wife, Elsie, he said, do you mind if we postpone the wedding? The light's really just right at this moment for painting. Can we push it off a little bit? And she said, okay. So art was always first and foremost. You know, I think he was a really nice man and shy in a way. But on the other hand, he got what he wanted. He was a great leader. So it's this dichotomy that we never quite resolved in our heads of how he could be both of those things, but I think he was.
Well, I think I've read that when he went to Europe, a lot of his colleagues were afraid that he would fall in love in Europe and never come back. And in fact, he did come back. And one of the places he did come back to, it's kind of interesting. A lot of his work was, I'm going to work in this area, you know, the Sierra. I'm going to work on the coast. I'm going to work in the Southwest. I'm going to Europe. He does come back to Canyon de Chelly after several years.
Yes.
What was
it?
What was
in the 1930s? He was there a lot.
What was special about that place for him? Do we know?
You know, what I can't resolve is exactly. So his first trip there was via the railroads, paid artists to go there and depict the landscape, and then they used it for promotion. And so that's how he first ended up in Canyon de Chelly in 1916. Then there's this long gap, until the very late 20s, and then most of the 30s is when he's doing his paintings of that area. What account, why he didn't do more in the 20s and the late teens there, I don't know. And we have never quite figured out. But once he started to do it in the 30s, then he went back over and over and over again, and he started to show in the Southwest as well. And I think for him, he was still in the 20s, still conquering the Sierra, and he's really interested in Europe. And I think by the 30s, he's ready for something else, and he's starting to look at this southwestern landscape and the sort of great open expanses with these beautiful iconic rocks and Navajo people on horseback. And he didn't do everything there. Like, one of the things author Peter Hasrick talks about is that sheep were ubiquitous at that time, but Edgar Payne never painted a sheep that we know of. So he was definitely choosy in the things that he was going to portray, and certain things he thought were acceptable and certain things he didn't think so.
Well, like a lot of Western American artists, it's an idealized view of that Western landscape. You go through just about every Western American artist, and they're depicting a West that no longer exists and is idealistic in many ways. And I assume Payne was doing the same with these solitary Navajo herdsmen. You never see the herds that they're keeping watch off over. Yeah. You're just seeing these incredible red rocks, orange rocks, incredible skies, and incredible cloud formations, and how insignificant man is in this huge landscape. I think that's what comes away from the Canyon de Chelly and Monument Valley and just all the Southwest paintings he did.
I think that's right. And I think that is something that actually is throughout his career, is that, you know, humanity is insignificant in this great expanse. And it really comes through because of the figures that are included in the late paintings give scale to these ideas. His Payne's daughter, you know, said, "I never thought of my father as a transcendentalist, but once I started to read about what transcendentalism was, I think that he actually thought about those things and had those ideas." And Payne did think of this sense of God in the landscape and sort of embodied in these scenes. And I think that those 30s paintings, especially with the sky and the weather, and, you know, that's really bringing this sort of spirituality and, you know, focusing on these elements in association with the permanency of the land below is what he was really trying to achieve.
You know, from the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about how we approach Edgar Payne from different directions. Myself from the Midwest and West, where, you know, we have such a wonderful facility about American Western art. We think of the Southwestern paintings, and I assume you in California think about the California landscapes. Has audiences in California sort of found the same thing about finding the Southwest? I think audiences in Tulsa are thinking, "Wow, I didn't know he did all this stuff in California."
That's interesting. You know, I've always said that there's something about California that makes it west of the West. And so a lot of people that think of Western art don't think of California art, but we're as far west as you can possibly get in this country. And so in a way, they're all Western paintings. But I agree with you that I think the Californians really thought of him as a Sierra painter, and I think elsewhere they thought of him as more of a, you know, desert Southwest painter. And then certain ones thought of him as a European boat painter, and I think he was all of those things. And it's just a matter of what your taste is.
Well, you can see all of the above examples of his work in the exhibit Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey, which is on display through March 24th. Scott Shields, thanks very much for taking time to talk with us, and thanks for your
pleasure.
Work on this exhibit.
Yes, thank you very much.
Scott Shields is the Associate Director and Chief Curator of the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento, California, one of the organizing institutions of the retrospective of the 20th century Western American landscape painter Edgar Payne. Edgar Payne, The Scenic Journey, will be on display through March 24th at Gilcrease Museum. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the Studio Tulsa section, and you can search our archives and look back at previous shows and listen online at your leisure. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.